You're listening to the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this episode is Diane Cohen. Diane, it's great to have you here.
Good morning, Eric. Great to be here.
So Diane, the way the show begins is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know to start this conversation?
Oh, I don't even know how to begin to answer something like that. I'm someone who's very happily living in this Ithaca, greater Ithaca community. See myself as one of many who are trying to make the world a little bit of a better place. And I'm a cat lover, and I'm very fortunate to have a wonderful family, and so I'm someone who's filled with gratitude just to be existing in this, I would describe as a very crazy time to be on this planet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And how? What is it that you do to try to hold this existence together at this crazy time?
It's a daily effort. I think our connectivity through technology to all the issues in the world is very overwhelming, mm-hmm. and so I think that there's almost hourly maintenance that needs to be paid attention to. I try to unplug a little bit. I mm-hmm. love being out in nature. I'm getting more and more connected. Okay. I'm actually becoming obsessed with trees and the how trees have a role in this world.
Uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
I've always loved them. I've only occasionally literally hugged a tree, but I think I could put myself into that category.
Emotional space.
Yeah. I understand the function of trees. Yeah. I have some heroes who are protecting them, and I think that how humans interrelate with them is fascinating.
Huh. Well, you brought some music with you.
I did.
And what would you like to open with?
One of my, we are so fortunate to have this international music festival and culture festival in our backyard in Trumansburg, the grassroots festival of music and dance. And I learned about this band. They're Navajo Diné, group of siblings. They used to be called Blackfire. They're now called Sihasin. And their father sometimes does some native vocals with them. And I think that this track has some of him playing with the brother and sister.
Okay. This is Child of Fire. Here we go.
Struck by lightning, hushed tongue.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this episode is Diane Cohen. So, Diane, where I like to go after that huge unanswerable question is actually another huge question, but it's kind of more answerable. What have you had to live through? What have you had to learn in order to know the life you want to live and some of the skills you may need to live it?
I heard the phrase lifelong learner somewhat after I graduated from college, and I remember being excited, and I very much identified with that. So I think it's a process. I remember being younger and really craving knowledge and wisdom, mm-hmm. so that some of these unanswered, perplexing questions could be resolved that I felt very overwhelmed by. And
wanted to resolve them.
I wanted to understand. And now, you know, I just turned 54, and I have been reflecting a little bit this past year about some of the knowledge I've gained and some of the understanding I've had, and maybe misperceptions when I was younger, and how grateful I am to the people in my life who have very gently shared knowledge, maybe not, you know, aggressively, but, you know, gently offering mm-hmm. Some of their wisdom. And you know, what have I had to learn? I think I have a quality of persistence that's really helped me through some very uneven times in, you know, whether career or life, that's really helped me push through. And I think now when I face enormous challenges, which happen to everyone, I'm better equipped to mm-hmm. get through them because I, you know, even recently employed the "it's going to be better tomorrow. I'm going to get through this horrible feeling I'm experiencing right today. It's going to lift.
This too shall pass."
Mm-hmm, exactly. So that I employ that frequently right now.
Yep. And but so what is some of the content, or what is some of the so you can look at yourself in a moment of crisis and say, "I just need to stay with this and it will go away."
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether I do, I mean, what, regardless of what I do, it's going to happen, mm-hmm. but it will go. Well, you said that you learned at a very, like, being a lifelong learner struck you very early on. What was that? What about the context of your childhood, or that kind of that launched you with such a desire and such determination?
Well, I'm not really sure. One person in my life who's very important to me is my older sister. She's 15 months older, and I talk about her a lot because I'm really proud of all the work she does. She, from my perspective anyway, I'm sure she did a lot of hard work, but she appeared to sail through elementary school, middle school, high school with A pluses without really seeming to have to study. And, you know, she just has a brilliant mind. And I was one grade behind her, struggling and, you know, happy to get a B plus if I could get to that. You know, I got an occasional A, but I was more in the C level a lot of times. And, you know, for sometimes it was my own fault, and sometimes it was just lack of concentration. You know, I felt academically not a natural, let's put it that mm-hmm, way. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I felt like my intelligence, I compared myself to her. Nobody else was, but I was comparing my intelligence to my sister's. And so I think I thought that maybe learning wasn't for me. You know, I think I made an early judgment of myself. Yeah. And so I was really grateful to be able to reframe that and understand that, oh, I can always be learning, and I can always kind of, the things I want to apply myself to, I can actually excel at.
Right. And why did academics matter to you? Was it just that you looked up to her, or was it the environment you were in?
I happen to love school, but I didn't do very well. I was very involved in a lot of the extracurricular things.
Sure.
I did some sports. I did a little theater.
You loved the whole of school.
I did. I was a little, I remember being embarrassed in senior year when they announced over the loudspeaker that I had perfect attendance the year before. I was shocked, and I was like, oh, I'm going to have to change that. But I enjoyed the environment. And so I think that there was probably an innate hunger for that, educational space sure. that I wasn't conscious of at the time.
Right. And you were enjoying it, even mm-hmm. if you weren't formally excelling at it.
Yes.
Did you and did your sister do the space in the same way, or did she?
She and I were very different and very similar. I mean, we're you know as our life arcs continue, sure. We have you know I, as we reconnect, I always realize how much more similar we are than uh-huh. Than different. I always thought of her as a very different person, but she was very different in high school. Her approach to things, we just were extremely, it felt extremely different, uh-huh, but probably uh-huh. not so much if I went back and analyzed it.
I'm one of seven kids, so mm-hmm. And people in town said, we don't know how seven such different people came out of a two-bedroom house. Mm-hmm. It's just not, it does, we, but when you... You kind of have to differentiate, and part of you know, especially when you're 15 months mm-hmm. apart, you tend to be sensitive to all the differences,
yeah,
as well as the similarities.
Yeah, and you know, she was the oldest. I'm one of five.
Uh-huh.
I feel like I have severe middle child syndrome.
but you're the second.
The next sibling is she's my younger sister, and mm-hmm. then there's two boys who are the youngest. So I'm the middle daughter.
Mm-hmm.
My younger sister claims middle right. childship.
Pure middle childship.
But she's the youngest daughter, so she...
She got the treatment.
I heartily disagree with her. We have an ongoing debate. And anyway... I think that impacted me. I felt a little invisible during right. when my parents were younger and overwhelmed by life. As I don't have
with
children,
five kids,
so,
who's not?
Yeah.
And what's the age span between the oldest and the youngest?
It's 13 years.
Okay, that's
so,
still pretty tight.
Yeah. There was a bundle of us
yeah.
when I in my formative years.
Yeah. So. My seven are spread across 20 years, mm-hmm. so they're like three little different families in mm-hmm. that cluster.
I can see that.
Yeah. So. You brought some more music with you, and we're going to try to play bits of it all. So, so let's cut to the next piece. Joni Mitchell.
So this, I think, this kind of relates to what you asked me earlier. How do you get through the hard times? I think sometimes this is a song that I discovered in my maybe early 20s, and I think. The way it speaks to me now is that you just need to allow yourself to feel. And I love the musicality of this entire record, Hissing of Summer Lawns, but this song in particular,
right.
I think is really accessible for people who might not know Joni Mitchell beyond the, they paved paradise and put up a parking lot, pop stuff.
Right. And I think, yeah. Here we go. Thank you.
Prophet witches, keep a light. A room full of glasses. He says, your notches, liberation doll. And he chains me with that serpent to that Ethiopian wall. And I'm arising, queen of queens. Wash my guilt of Eden. Wash and balance me. And I'm arising, uprising in me tonight. She's a vengeful little goddess with an ancient crown to fight. Truth goes up in vapors, the steeples lean. Winds of change, patriarchs, snug in your Bible belfry. Up the chimney like childhood Santa Claus. The good slaves love the good book. A rebel loves a cause. Mm-hmm. on the 115. You're darn right. Since I was 17, I've had no one over me. He says, and I'm rising. So what? Petrified wood, processed tall timber. Sorrow. Darn right. He says, we walked on the moon. Rhine wine, milk of the Madonna, clandestine. He don't let up the sorrow. He lies and he cheats. It takes a heart like Mary's these days when your man gets weak.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this episode is Diane Cohen. So, Diane, that's a very powerful song about sorrow, and you had said that it was formative in kind of your coming to understand. What in your own experience of sorrow made you realize that you can't move it along?
Mm.
You can't rush it. How did you come to accept or notice that?
Mm. I'm a very fortunate person in terms of loss and grieving. That the major losses in my life have come more recently. So through my 20s, really, I didn't lose a close friend or a family member. I saw other people close to me mourning and grieving, but I just didn't have that type of tragedy.
Right. No, and many people don't.
But the next song that we're going to get to is written by a close friend of mine, Mary Lorson, and she and I used to work in a noted local
establishment.
I would call it a community center. Other people would call it a nightclub, but it was the Rongovian Embassy. But Mary, when I was grieving the loss of a relationship, it wasn't a death, but I was really hit hard. And she was the one who said... to me first and use that phrase, this will lift, you know, it gave me that. She didn't tell me when it was going to be, but she said it with such conviction. Mm-hmm. And she helped me along through a really tough time. So that was a first, lived mm-hmm. experience of, it lifted and then it reappeared and then it lifted again. And there was many cycles to, mm-hmm. to get through that, that first heartbreak, really.
Right. Grief is not one and done. And in fact, if...
And since, part of the reason I wanted to choose Don't Interrupt the Sorrows, I believe Jaco Pastorius is the bass player in that. And Eric Ott, who is the owner of the Rongovian Embassy, was a dear friend and a mentor to me and a wonderful person. And he passed away a little over 3 years ago. And but he revered Jaco Pastorius. Eric himself was a brilliant bass player, and I still miss him all the time and think of him, and many, many people do. Mm-hmm. So I think, that's a cycle of grieving, missing him or other close people that I just recognize, and I don't know if acceptance is the right thing, but I allow for it, and I allow myself to feel that moment, because it's an acknowledgement that's kind of beyond the physical realm, right? And
to
be in that space and to honor that relationship and the loss and wherever, however that person who had a, who was a light in this world remains one, right?
Right.
In our hearts. And
yeah.
And so I've had a series of close losses over the last decade, as we all do, and I reflect a lot about that, and just like to give space to those moments, or hours, or mm-hmm. days, or
right.
weeks, or months, whatever they are,
right.
And try to just reflect and carry that being on in my heart and in my actions.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that Mary's comment to you was part of that gentle wisdom that you mm-hmm. spoke of at the very
Absolutely,
opening.
Absolutely, yeah. She was an important and, wise friend.
Right. What I want to come back to, though, is while waves of grief or new grievings, new things to grieve, take us to a similar hollow or hallowed space, it's not exactly the same space mm-hmm. ever.
No.
And so the light that comes into that particular darkness is always a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And so how have you changed, or how has your awareness of what you value in relationships changed by being able to hold on to the grief?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm far more present in my important relationships. I proactively make space for them. I wish I could do more. And, you know, this crazy busy world steps on our ability to, I think, the way I would like to properly steward those relationships
sure.
and friendships. But
but also that's almost anticipatory grief, and that we can't be everything to everybody, you know, and but there's, cause we're limited, and if we stretch ourselves too
yeah.
thin, then we're useless.
Well, that's a good point, but I wouldn't call being present in a relationship anticipatory grief.
No. But the only thing I was talking about mm-hmm. there was the realization that you're not quite as present as you would like to be.
Yes.
That just and the acceptance of that.
Yeah.
It's like a little wonder that you're not going to get, maybe not mm-hmm. in the way that you wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a sad place, but it's also, I could make a different choice and will if I can.
I like that. I feel like this is therapy now. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
No. I think it's a great way to think about it. I think I'm very much in that realm. Very recent losses. You know, I'm reflecting a little bit about that.
Bring everybody closer in these recent losses.
I'm just returning. I just returned yesterday from a quick trip to Albany, where my entire nuclear family, as my parents are still alive, and I went to go celebrate and just have a special occasion moment, just a day in the life with them, because I've liked to do that for years. And it was, everybody converged because I was arriving in town, which was nice and special.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And, and it still didn't feel like enough. And yet I'm so grateful that I did it.
It's yeah. And it's
mm-hmm.
both.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost always both mm-hmm. if we're honest about it.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, your work as an activist and as a leader takes you into new relationships and new people all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that can feel disingenuous because, you know, you can't be everybody's best friend, even mm-hmm. though you may collaborate deeply and intensely for a moment on an issue or something. But life, how have you learned to live with that?
I think that I'm in my 19th year of working in nonprofit leadership, and I also bartended in this town for 19 years.
And, this is the break-even point.
I'm finally in this balanced mode. There were 8 years of overlap. I bartended for eight years while I was in nonprofits, but I'm not that old, but I'm getting pretty old. I think bartending taught me a lot about managing relationships. I identify as a very shy person, and people seem shocked when I say I'm an introvert. People say no, but
you know how to perform.
Well, I'm learning, and I think, you know, my confidence is slowly eking higher. And as you well know, you asked me to do this a year ago, and I said I'm not ready.
And I think it was more like 3 years.
Well,
ago.
Well, it might have been.
It took a while.
I think I'm still finding my voice.
Uh-huh.
I think about that a lot right now, because I And I feel very honored and privileged to be representing something that I think is really important in the reusing of materials world. And I'm looked to at least vocalize the, you know, the leading edge of where we're going. Mm-hmm. We live in a progressive community that's invested very generously in this this approach, this kind of alternative approach to consumption, and I'm still really trying to find my space in that, and I'm given a lot I'm given a lot of respect before I feel like I've earned it. So I'm working to bring that into balance right now. I think that we're in our 11th year at Finger Lakes Reuse, and I want to, you know, I think people are looking to that organization as a leader, and so I'm trying to find myself as the leader of that organization to kind of digest the most important pieces and bring mm-hmm. them forward. And so back to your question, I think, and bartending taught me how to interact with many people. Mm-hmm. I think as a shy person, I never would have seen myself being able to manage as many relationships as I do. And I don't think I manage them as well as I'd like to, but it's something that I'm thinking about a lot. Right. I'm very good at like kind of popcorning around with different people and, you know, going to the farmer's market and someone wants to talk about some aspect of their experience because we have many, many people shopping and donating and we're touching a lot of people, which is a wonderful thing. And I've gone from, you know, I used to feel a little bit of resentment that this is my free time. You know, I don't want to talk about this all the time. And now I welcome it. And so I've experienced an internal shift in how I receive others, and I think that I've actually grown into feeling like I'm part of a community that where the more we can exchange some information, the more I can sort of digest that into something that's something to be determined important, where we can actually make a difference collectively, because I've got a lot of energy and people working on this issue now, and I want to, I'd like it to take it to the activism level, and I'm still considering exactly how to do that.
Right. What you just said was so powerfully interesting, and I was getting taken. You had said something that I heard as you were given more respect than you in a sense had earned. And it's always dangerous when everyone speaks well of you, because then something that's a, you know, the people don't know you, mm-hmm. or they don't know how to engage you. But what you just said, and partly was that it seems like you don't feel like you have a mutually accountable relationship until you know each other.
Sure.
And what happened? We have in this culture this notion that we have a private life mm-hmm. and we have a public life, mm-hmm. but that's kind of a bullshit distinction. Mm-hmm. We have a personal life, which we have a community life, and the boundary between those two is very pliable and it's ambiguous. Mm-hmm. It's gray. And now you walk around as the whole person that you are, which is part of the history of the Rongovian and mm-hmm. part of the history of Finger Lakes Reuse mm-hmm. and, you know, part of all of this, and they can just meet you mm-hmm. and you do the work. What I found is that if people can do the work when they want to, and they don't have to schedule a meeting or go through a hoop mm-hmm. to do it, it's a lot less charged, and it gets done a lot with a lot more grace.
Yeah. There's a deeply organic quality to our organization, to my work style. I've been very fortunate to have a lot of autonomy. It's our board of directors is incredibly supportive and gives me a lot of space mm-hmm. to... You know, they see that something's happening, and they've, you know, something positive that they've, it's the reason they volunteer their time, and they've been incredibly just supportive and really engaged and caring. So I'm surrounded by this support system that gives me space to be myself. So I, sure. And then, you know, then I have to question, well, what is that? And how can I be as effective as possible? But the organization also, has this organic quality because of my style, whatever mm-hmm. that is, still to be defined, perhaps. But
and your style and your hiring choices and mm-hmm. your those you recruit for the board, if they don't understand it, it's not going to work well.
Right. And we found in our organization there's a strong work ethic that seems to tie people together. You know, certainly the purpose of why we're doing what we're doing, and people have different. It means different things to different people, but I've found that. My first inclination was, to attempt to direct, and I've joked that I'm, my best management skill is micromanagement, and I've learned, repeatedly that's really not effective. And so,
So you go from big picture to minutia in an instant.
I'm a detail person. I think that I have some vision of, where I hope we can go. And then my experience in the past in all of my careers is that I pay attention to details.
Right. And it's the next drink to serve. It's the next piece on the...
and so finding balance within that is challenging. And my coworkers have laughed at me when I've said things like, it's an evolving process. And, that organic quality, which I welcome, mm-hmm. is, I think, very challenging if you come in as a new employee to understand, what is the structure of all of this? And we, I'm very proud that I was able to bring in this non-hierarchical organizational structure that I read about, thanks to actually being invited to speak at an Ithaca College class, Anthony Dorenzo's grant writing class worked with us, and he really kind of forced me to read the syllabus that he was presenting to the students, and which was good. I've found that we get more out of the students the closer we work with them. If we just hand them a project and let them go, right. it's a it very different work. Experience. And so I read this Peter Drucker Managing the Nonprofit Organization book that was maybe 20 or 30 years old, and I found this just short paragraph that was like a light bulb and a bell going off at the same time. You can either have a hierarchically based organization, which I was always uncomfortable with, always that pyramid mm-hmm. with the executive director mm-hmm. at the top. I never felt comfortable with that. I tried to invert that pyramid, and we did for a little while. But he said you can have a hierarchically based organization where people have authority over other people, mm-hmm. which I feel a deep discomfort, and or you can have a communications-based organization where you know who to give information to and who to get information from to do your job well. So we talk about that a lot. We don't have an updated, illustrated organizational chart when we've tried to illustrate it and mm-hmm. put all the our brilliant graphic designer Brian Dudla actually. Put lines of circuitry, like a circuitry board between all the people. And I had a coworker say, this is very confusing to me. But if you're just acting it and understanding, right. I have information, I need to share this with someone. And I watched our organization transform. I watched how emails and how our systems of communicating evolved because people got the big picture. They're like, our understanding is that we need to communicate differently and more thoroughly and more effectively. And so people thought about that, and that's been really fantastic.
Right. So I'm going to put it in more blunt terms. You can have relationships or you can have rights. Mm. Hierarchies structure rights. Mm-hmm. Relationships work with the mess mm-hmm. of valued people produce economic value. Because of the relationship, I value you as a person, not as a role.
I like that.
And it's just really powerful the way you've lived it.
I think we're in. I describe it as a phenomenon to my coworkers. I mean, I'm shocked at the volume of materials we're seeing, the volume that we're handling, the growth that we're experiencing, and the most shocking thing is how little grand plan, grand design mm-hmm. I'm offering. This is truly an organic evolution with a group of people who there is some direction. We certainly give some parameters of mm-hmm. expectations about behavior and how we interact.
And decency and fairness.
Yeah, we talk about safety, respect, and resourcefulness as our key values. Yeah. And we say if you make decisions incorporating those three things, you're going to be fine, no matter if this is your first day or your 10th year.
Decency, respect, and resourcefulness?
Safety, respect, and resourcefulness. Respect. And it is, it's very, you know, reuse, the nature of reuse is chaos. I mean, everything is different shaped. We don't know what's going to come in. We sell a refrigerator and we get two sofas donated. We have to constantly rearrange things. We have to, you know, make sure things are safe and clean and, you know, attempting it, organizing. Right. And humans love to make order out of chaos. There is a lot of space for people to find meaningful work within our operations.
Right. And just enough order to make something intelligible is helpful, but so much of our culture is based on making more order than we really need.
Well, every time we get on top of a department in one of our two reuse centers, we get complaints from customers that are like, oh, you know, the thrill of the hunt is gone.
That's right.
and we kind of say, don't worry, it'll be back. But, you know, we're constantly just trying to improve. And being in that environment, for me, for someone who, you know, my father used to say, you can't sit still. And it was a criticism. To have this constant change environment, which we have, is, I think it's the environment I thrive in, and a number of us in the organization, and other people who really need things to be more steady. Those people, we have one of my longest coworkers would prefer things to be in order and stable all the time, and many people would, because that's a comfortable place. But he's learned to adapt and understand that the normal thing that he can expect every day is that it's going to be different, and he's been able to manage it, and he's a wonderful person.
Right. And to come to the point in life where my preferences are my preferences, I'm not God, or I'm not, you know, that's just, I mean, it's a, you work with it.
Mm-hmm.
Diane, what should we play next?
I talked about my dear friend Mary Lorson, who's just a brilliant musician. She's sold records worldwide, and we're very fortunate to have her here in this community. So this is from her most recent record.
Theme from Whatever.
Hey, you can take what you want from me, whatever you like. Yeah, I think it's all right. If there's something you require that I might provide, whatever you like. Yeah, I think it's all right. Surviving by the skin of my teeth.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Diane Cohen. So, Diane, how have you had to change in ways that you might not have wanted to, but found it important to do so?
Well, a story I often tell because I have to do a lot of public speaking is I was an art major at Ithaca College. I felt like, as I was explaining earlier, not academically, I just wasn't sure what my academic path of for success could be. And I had excelled a little bit at painting and drawing and a little bit of sculpture. So I thought I'd give Ithaca College a try. And I did have, you know, some sort of intellectual awakening thanks to the philosophy and politics departments there. And I ended up with a politics minor and being most profoundly, I think, influenced by the philosophy department, and one professor in particular, Linda Finlay, who's still around this town. And I think she really helped me get out of the gate. What happened in college was when the syllabus would be passed out at the beginning of the semester, and I would quickly scan through it for one purpose. If there was a public speaking component, if you had to give a presentation in front of the class, I dropped it. I dropped the class.
Wow.
And since I got into the nonprofit world, people have wanted to hear about the program I'm managing or the organization I'm running. And and so I've now spoken publicly hundreds of times. And I said 19 years I've been doing this, probably for the first 15, I would say before every single public speaking opportunity, this is my curse. This is what I get for dropping every class. And I really, really struggled with that aspect of it. I've found, I'm still nervous coming here and talking to you. Like I said, I'm still finding my voice. And
sure.
But I'm gaining confidence in that world. And it's with lots and lots of support and people cheering me on and, you know, learning that nothing horrible happens, even if I don't speak very well. People are still interested in, you know, certain components. So my fear has been greatly reduced around that arena. But it's been a huge thing for me.
Right. So you said the first 15 years, so 4 years ago, something changed. What did you start saying?
You know, I think the biggest thing is we're in our 11th year of operating reuse centers, and I think I went from speaking about what I was hoping we were going to be able to do to the majority of what I'm talking about is achievements we've actually...
What you've done.
Yes, and having that more concrete... I don't know if I'm a visual person in a visual mind, but being able to, to visualize the things that we've done as opposed to the things that I'm hoping we're going to do feels like safer ground to stand on when I'm speaking.
And it is ground because it already exists.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so, I think to me the difference though is primarily now you have a balance of the vulnerability of the unknown and the experience, some of it not always pleasant, of what you've been through.
Sure.
And that's a more to use. I mean, that you can fight in that space and play in that space and be real in that space.
I think with the there's always more future than experienced past in front of us, and it's the vast unknown. I'm in a moment right now. It's budget time. We're planning for next year, and I'm trying to consider how to forge forward. You know, people are waiting for, where are we going? What is this going to look like? And I'm circling back to. I think a mentorship model where I'm going to have a series of one-on-one conversations with people to help, including Linda is on my list and Mary Lorson, and I'd love to talk to you a little bit. You know, I think that there's, using the resources and the lived experience of this community that's so rich in ideas and experience, and not, you know, allowing myself to not just channel my own experiences and kind of broaden that into some sort of product that I can bring forward to my board to look at, and you know, ideally as a model that other communities can replicate.
Right, right. And I may be projecting a little bit here, but there's a way in which to really move forward in these chaotic and trying times is to know how to wrestle with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it can be hurt. It can be harsh.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, we don't mean to hurt each other, but when you wrestle, everybody has stuff at stake and they really want to move it all forward, and just kind of being in the middle of the scrum or the whatever you want to call it, it's kind of rough. It seems though that you're at a space where the value of doing that outweighs the pulling back from it.
Yeah, I've definitely been in enough meetings with people with different opinions that you know, I've learned that you can have you know, conflict or conflicting opinions, and you can debate things with civility and respect, right? And so I think sharing opposing ideas is okay. I think, you know, the organization I run is not at all what I would have done if it was just up
to
me.
To you.
This is very much a product of many participants and visions and skills and talents and interests. And right. So, you know, it truly is a community effort. I'm, you know, just, I think we'll be constantly trying to, in that very organic way, like a tree root sending out a tendril, right? Or
right.
The next leaf or branch, looking for that next, you know, what is the next space I'm growing into to help support the greater system.
Right, right, right. And the piece that I'm highlighting is that it's kind of intellectual and polite, but it's also visceral and
mm-hmm.
kind of get into reactions you never knew were coming,
mm-hmm.
and emotional in terms of just
mm-hmm.
loves and hates and, mm-hmm. and denials and all sorts of engagements that are just dealing with real people.
Mm-hmm. I did learn a while ago, and it's really helped me, that I really can't control what other people, how they're going to react.
Sure.
I can control my own emotions during, you know, a tense conversation. And so if I can try to manage myself, I can really take any kind of other viewpoint. I've heard it all, it feels like, at this
right,
point.
Right.
And I'm used to hearing hurtful things, you know, and yeah. managing them and being able to not react in the moment.
Not retaliate, but also respond.
You know, I'm certainly not perfect in that, but I've
yeah.
gotten a lot better
yeah.
at understanding how to communicate
right.
in that realm.
And when we don't live with the assumption of privilege, we expect to be challenged in painful and hurtful ways,
mm-hmm.
and we just deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
But when the expectation of privilege is there, it's got to be polite, it's got to be blah,
mm-hmm.
blah, blah, and it's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of was almost a lead into Stevie Wonder.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So here we go. Don't you
Great.
Worry about a thing.
Cindy, Mama, you understand that? Well, like, I don't understand that you can, because, like, I've been to, you know, Paris, Beirut, you know, I've been to Iraq, Iran, Eurasia, you know, I speak very, very fluent Spanish. Todo está bien chévere. You understand that?
Bien chévere.
Chévere?
Bien
chévere. Is that right, Mama? Yeah, because I got my shaking room.
Everybody's got a thing, but some don't know how to handle it. Always reaching out in vain, just taking the things not worth having. But don't you worry about a thing. Don't you worry about a thing, Mama. 'Cause I'll be standing on the side when you check it out. Your style of life's a drag, and that you must go other places. But just don't you feel too bad when you get fooled by smiling faces. But don't you worry about a thing. Don't you worry about a thing, Mama.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Diane Cohen. So, Diane, the way I close out the show is with a question about how you take care of yourself and how you learn to do that. What do you do to take care of yourself physically, emotionally, and intellectually? And, you know, what do you do? And then we'll talk about, you know, daily, weekly. We'll talk about, you know, when you know you need to do it. Sure. And also maybe when in life you learned that was your job. Many of us don't learn until we're, you know, well along into our 40s, 50s, or 60s that really the first job is to put the mask on yourself and take care of yourself and, you know, yeah, the oxygen mask, that is.
I was very fortunate to be a super high energy person when I was younger, and especially all the years I was bartending, you're constantly moving. And so I think I had a... because of the physical nature of that job, I was in pretty good shape. And then I've, you know, drifted more and more to a desk job, and my health has simultaneously taken a hit as I've become more, you know, static.
Sedentary,
And so I have realized I need to get out and move and figure out how to do that. And I would say I'm not great at it still, but I don't think I do it as much as I need to. But
you're aware of the problem.
And I know I feel better I walks in the woods and I try to exercise, and yoga's been nice, but I'm very sporadic at all of those things. I find for the physical and emotional, a walk in the forest is so healing and rejuvenating and uplifting. And so I'm, you know, only recently trying to consciously do more and more of that, and with some success this gorgeous spring, summer, and fall. It's just been phenomenal weather, and we live in such a rich area to do that. I think the intellectual side, because of the nature of my job as an executive director, I was worried from the beginning about ego issues, being... intellectually informed enough to be up to the task. I like to read, but I'm not a super fast reader. I'm very overwhelmed by the options of things to read, just starting with email and then everything else. But I think that I've found that the way to survive that is I really rely on my community. And how do I define my community? It's huge. This town, I've been here for more than 35 years. I think I really craved community as a kid. I didn't feel like our family was as immersed in community as I would have liked. I think that's why I probably spent as much time doing extracurricular things at school, because that's where I started to feel some of that. And I decided to stay in Ithaca because I identified it as a community I related to. And as a result, between bartending and nonprofit work, I've built many relationships. And so I depend on, some of the high-level teachings or issues that my colleagues share. You know, sometimes I absorb it by osmosis, but I'm out there reaching out. And so, you know, one issue that...
Can I just interrupt? Yeah. You seem to have a big enough variety of friends and connections that somebody's going to bring stuff to you.
Oh, yeah.
And you trust that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, recognition of my own privilege, for example. Sure, sure. And, you know, more deeply understanding issues of racism and, you know, right here in this community, not to mention what's going on in this country and the world. Slavery still happens. I'm involved in, we have labor happening, and we push for equity, you know, in our organization. And to me, that's a form of activism where we're creating a healing space that counters some of these far more oppressive systems that are still, pretty active almost everywhere we turn. And so I think that my well-being has been informed by my community, and I've really learned to depend on the experts and the kindness of the people around me to help me continue to learn and grow and be effective in these issues that I think are really important, that we need to provide positive space to kind of counter against some of these negative oppressions.
And one of the if you're a highly self-critical person, which I could heard in your earlier comment, one of the things is that you can hear your own self-criticisms more than those of others around you, and there the input from others and trusting that can actually be more valuable than your own the noise in your own head. But it's a hard transition sometimes to make, and to not indulge that in your own head.
Certainly.
The other thing that I wanted came to mind is that a lot of what is emotional care is relational care with other people. And you talked about the big change when going to the farmer's market. You didn't want to be doing business about something that happened or a thought somebody had about reuse or whatever. But you've become open to that. But still, it's still important to be able to have the space where you can emotionally connect to people with more of a sense that it's mutual rather than you're fulfilling a need. How do you make that time or those connections for people in your life?
Well, I learned how to listen. I think being able to be in a listening space. I don't think I was a good listener for the first half of my life, and maybe more. And I think being able to actively understand what someone else is bringing to a conversation It's almost like a fun sport in a way that I've discovered that it's much more rich to hear someone else speak than to hear myself. And so I've gotten a lot better at hearing what someone cares about. It doesn't matter. I don't care if it's about my organization or something I don't know anything about. I find that interesting now. And I'm really glad I've kind of arrived at that space, because life's more interesting, not just being stuck in my own, I've got to get this point across mode in a conversation, even if it's just a 2-minute conversation. More hearing where a person's at, that's so informative for me as well.
Yeah. And it's really hearing the person as much as it is what they're saying. Mm-hmm. You're hearing the wholeness.
I feel like we live in a peaceful community where, you know, a huge variety of opinions and experiences kind of coexist. And I find it's a fascinating way to, you know, that people are so approachable and feel like they can approach. I love going to the farmer's market for the social aspect.
Sure, sure.
I love supporting the farmers that I want to keep coming. I will buy a $4 head of lettuce or whatever, just to support that. Because I think we live in a Garden of Eden, and I think the social and community aspect there is a really beautiful thing.
Diane, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Thanks a lot, Eric.
So we're going to close with Sihasan and Gentler Than the Night. Thank you.
Thank you.